Listener, and welcome back to Flight Through Entirety, the only Doctor Who podcast held together by people just being terribly critical of one another. I'm Brendan.
I'm Nathan.
I'm Todd.
And we're going into a Johnny Byrne's a debut script for the series with The Keeper of Traken.
And this one is mine. I put up my hand. I absolutely and utterly adore this story. It's my favourite of the season, and I've always liked it ever since I was a kid. I considered a few other stories, like I considered Four to Doomsday, which I like, and but it's got a few problems. I considered Attack of the Cybermen, which I like, but it's got a few problems. And I considered The Mysterious Planet, which I really like, but it's got a few problems. So I thought I'd go to this one, which I really like. And you know what? It's not the best directed of the season, although I think John Black is really trying as the director. He's really trying hard. It's not the best script of the season, maybe because the mast has to be shoehorned into it. But I think the performances by the majority of the cast, I think the actual casting, the costuming, and the set design really, really sell this as a piece of television.
They're spectacular, aren't they?
Yeah. And you know, the costumer, Amy Roberts, the designer, Tony Burrow, was not. He could not get the set designer he wanted, so there was this up-and-coming designer in the BBC department. And it's one of these things I've talked about in previous podcasts with the serendipity of this season. Things happen quite by accident, and often you get somebody new and enthusiastic, and here the design of, you know, the keepers in a sanctum and the grove and the just everything. I just think it just works so beautifully. So beautifully. But I guess, I mean, we'll start, you know, right at the beginning where we've got the Doctor and a male companion in the TARDIS for the first time since, Wheel in Space, would it be?
Yes, absolutely. So that's 1968, so 13 years.
Mm. I don't like that opening scene, can I say? I think we've had... Adric and Tom have been largely separated from each other. So either Tom and Lala have headed off and Adric's had his own plot, or Tom's headed off and Lala and Adric have had their own plot. And so this is the first time we get Tom and Adric together. I think they work quite well, don't you?
I do. Yeah. And one of the things I love about these final eight episodes of the season is that I think that it gives the character of Adric the opportunity to be with the Doctor.
Yeah.
It gives Matthew a bit of, I don't know, stability, or the fact that he is the most senior person in the TARDIS crew. And I think he's much more comfortable is the word I'm going to use throughout these two stories. And I think he probably delivers his best performance in the next story. Here I think he's still finding his feet a bit through some scenes, but at other times I think he's quite competent. I mean, he's never going to be great, and he's, you know, he's always awkward in his movements and that sort of thing. But I really do feel that this back eight episodes of this season are some of the best stuff that he does on the show.
He's not being required to do things that he's terrible at, like, you know, the conflict that starts creeping into the TARDIS crew next season, which he's always just kind of terrible in.
Yeah, and it's really interesting to see him acting with Sarah Sutton. They actually have a really good but low-key chemistry together.
Yeah.
You know, whereas...
That won't last.
Well, that's the thing. As we get further into the 80s, chemistry in John Nathan Turner's mind seems to be people shouting at each other. That's chemistry. Whereas these two, they're really quite sweet together. It's like they've never had a friend their own age who is as intelligent as them. And we know that's the case for Adric.
Yeah.
Because we know his background. We don't see any other people on Traken and Nissa's age. So they immediately take to each other and they sort of do sciencey chat with each other. And there's a little bit of banter of, oh, you don't know this, but I know this. Yeah, they're very, very sweet together.
Can we go back to that first scene, which I really don't like, which I think is a big misstep, and that's where the Keeper of Traken flits in to do some exposition.
But I love that.
Yeah.
I love the fact that this is the first time that somebody's come into the TARDIS. We're doing flashbacks using the TARDIS scanner. We've got that wonderful shot which is a mimic of the shot back in The Leisure Hive where the camera goes through the scanner into the scene. And to me, this is the first time we're actually doing flashbacks in a Doctor Who story of this nature. And I love the whole thing about the Keeper. You've got the Keeper, you've got the consoles, you've got the proctors, you've got this society, you've got all the different planets working together. I imagine that there are other Keeper cabinets on the other planets with other consoles for those planets, but Traken is the major one. I was dreaming this as a kid, like the whole society and what was going to happen and all this sort of thing. It inspired my imagination.
I think it's really strong. I do think that the result is you do get a place that has very clear rules that you can understand really well. But it is, like, I think it's just a little bit leaden. And you imagine if it was to happen now, what you would do is you would start seeing the world and having it shown to you and not just explained to you by exposition guy, and then you would go 10 years later or 5 years later.
Yeah, that's a good point, but I think that is the point. In 1981, this hadn't really been done.
No.
So the idea, of course, you know, films and TV have always had what we now call info dumps, sort of expositional dialogue. This is, at the very least, an interesting way of doing it, because the Keeper could just turn up and say, oh, we have this problem, Doctor, please come and help us, which is kind of what Zaster does in Megloss.
Mm.
But this is a lot more interesting because we see that history. And I think that's something that's very much coming from Johnny Byrne. Johnny Byrne always tries in his mind, he always has a backstory to his stuff. Because Johnny, for science fiction fans, is probably most famous for being script editor and one of the script writers of Space 1999. And quite a few episodes of early Space 1999 start with an alien somehow turning up on the base and giving a bit of exposition. And maybe not at the beginning, like episodes like Alpha Child, episodes like Earthbound, you know. I think it's more successful here because in Space 1999 you've got 20 minutes of Barbara Bain looking at the camera saying, but is it safe? Whereas this, you have wonderful banter between Tom Baker and Dennis Carey, you know, which is adorable.
Todd's exploding.
It is Space 1999. It's sort of like you're trying to sell Johnny Byrne on the back of that. I guess it is season one, which is better than season two.
Season two goes to hell. It's awful.
Going back, you were trying to make a point about...
Oh, no. I just said that I thought that the exposition... And maybe I'm being unfair, but certainly by modern standards, it's kind of leaden and it slows things down. And are we to understand that they arrive on the wedding day?
No.
So they arrive
after the wedding.
Yeah.
So just after the wedding. Because then we get the scene, if all the stars were silver and if I were in a Shakespeare play, I couldn't be happier than I am right now. And that's not in the flashback, is it?
That's actually happening. So I think in terms of chronology, if you like, the Keeper turns up to bless the wedding, sees Cassia's reaction to Tremas being put forward, and then summons the Doctor because he's like, hold on, you know, this isn't how Trakens react to so great an honor.
So skipped out on the reception.
Yeah, exactly.
Get the Doctor to come, and then the Doctor arrives.
It's really interesting. Like, again, this is a story where a character knows about the Doctor. This is something that's beginning to happen more and more in 80s Doctor Who, which I don't particularly love.
Yeah.
Right? But it's there, and at the moment it hasn't happened too often, which is perfectly okay. Obviously, we get to see Melka appear in the flashbacks with young Cassia, which is all very convenient. That's the one thing that, you know, that Melka decides to manifest itself by just descending rather than...
materializing.
Of course, that would give the whole plot away. I mean, it's the one thing now that when I do watch it is that, you know, the Doctor is aware of the energy readings of Melka and is suspicious, but I think it takes him far, far too long to sort of come to the realization that this is the Master.
So the Master has allowed himself to get trapped, because the word Melka is the Trakan's name for a phenomenon that happens.
Yeah, fly trapped in honey.
Yeah, so these things, so the Master's allowed himself to do this. He's been in the TARDIS trapped for like 20 years or something, like since Cassia was a little girl.
Yeah.
You see, to me when I read it, I don't necessarily see him as being trapped per se. That's the Trakan perspective, that these things have been
trapped.
So he, for all purposes, realises that the Keeper's time is drawing to an end.
And so he's waiting for
him. But why wouldn't he just then materialise, 3 minutes before the Keeper's going to drop dead to take over the source? Because he's got a plan, his traps within traps for Castrovalva and Logopolis in case it all goes horribly wrong over the next two stories. Am I going off on a complete...
No, because I don't think he's developed those plans yet. He does say to the Doctor later, you will find immobility and durable. Mm. Do you know what I mean? So it does suggest that he has been trapped. The Melka thing looks tremendous. The statue is great.
Yeah. Beautiful.
And when it moves, like, it's a bit...
I actually like how it moves.
I do too. I think it's slightly dodgy on some of the leg movements, but the head and all that, and I just think it's a great design, and it really is quite freaky.
Surprising, I think, when it starts moving as well. Oh. It does look like it's going to be a statue, and then it walks up at the end of episode one.
With the Master's long game, if you like, I actually really, really like it, because we kind of discussed in Deadly Assassin the character had been weakened and he was just a raving madman and what have you, who wanted to blow up the world because it's there. Whereas here, okay, so the Master knows that the Keeper's gonna die, but rather than materialize 3 minutes before, he's immobile, he's trapped in his TARDIS, so he's like, right, I'm gonna get there 20 years before, and I'm going to build up this relationship with a person, and then I'm going to use that person. The Master's always used people, but instead, he can't use his hypnotic power, and with the way evil works on Trakan, that's apparently calcified, that it's understandable that he can't just pop out of the TARDIS and go, zap, you're in my power now. No, he doesn't sort of hypnotize Cassia until the events of the story, and even then it's just to strengthen the hold he already has on her. But the thing is, he hasn't spoken to her before the story. No. His entire psychological hold on her, she's made herself. Mm-hmm. It's so evil and insidious, and I love it. They decided they wanted to bring back the Master, and they look at what are his greatest qualities, not that he kills people, that's the Daleks thing. Not that he's cold and logical, that's the Cybermen thing. No, his main quality is he can turn people against themselves.
Just what you've said has made me love this story even more. It's something I never really thought about.
The Master's a late addition, isn't he?
Yes, Johnny Byrne had delivered the scripts, and then he went off onto holiday, and then Nathan Turner decided that it would be great to bring the master back. Let's put him into this story, and Bidmead had to then do the work to do that. I don't know what the difference is between the original and that, but if Melka was there, and Melka's long game was to get into the Keeper's chair, making the changes, I think it adds a layer to the story.
Yeah, absolutely.
But do you think it was a good idea to bring back the Master?
In the long term, no. But in the short term, I think it really works for this and the next two stories. I think that bridging that is good. After that, I think, what they do with the Master is pretty pathetic.
Well, they're not really thinking about the character in another sense. I mean, Brendan, what you say about him manipulating people and making them act against their own interest. But what the Master really is a rival who threatens to take over the Doctor's role as star of the program. He needs to be the opposite of the Doctor. And so each new iteration of the Doctor really needs a different Master. You've got Delgado, who is patrician, arrogant, but foreign. He's like a version of Pertwee, and he works with Pertwee. Here you've got Ainley, who's not really designed to work with a particular Doctor. He has a goatee because that's what he had in the 70s, and he's just along because that's the sort of thing that Doctor Who used to do.
But of course, Ainley is not the Master yet. He's Treemas, and he's rather wonderful as Treemas.
This is Anthony Ainley's best performance in Doctor Who, in my opinion, and I utterly adored Treemas. I was utterly not devastated, but really upset at the end of the story when he gets when he is murdered.
I think it's an amazingly upsetting ending.
Mm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I just adore Tremes as a character. Like this father, this husband, this really good, honest man who can talk to the doctor, who wants to protect his people. It's just, it affects me now just talking about it. It's only, I don't know, it's like the Pip and Jane Baker thing. The more you see of the actor or their writing, the more you see the cliches in their performance. So there's certain ways that Anthony Ainley pronounces his words, etc., now that I see in the performance of Tremes, only because I've seen his performance of The Master, you know?
Do you know, I don't think he's that good. And I think the reason is, and it's maybe the script's problem and maybe the director as well, but it's his wedding day and the day after his wedding day, and he's just curiously kind of unaffected by the death of his wife and by her acting all weird and out of character. You know, like, he shows no affection really to Nyssa at all, and he doesn't really seem to show any affection to Cassia either.
Yeah, see, though, I think the Trakans are, they're a little bit Vulcan. You know, they're so science-y minded that, the only character who sort of expresses what we would consider as negative human elements is Neiman, and, you know, he's an opportunist and what have you, and that's seen as a bad thing. I suppose you've also got Luvik. I love Luvik.
I like Luvik as well.
I thought he was John Leeson when I was a kid. You know, he looks like John Leeson. But there's that wonderful bit, I think it's episode 2, where Ceron is killed.
John Woodnut.
John Woodnut is back again and being wonderful, and they're discussing what's happening. Keturah, who is Margot Vandenberg. She's
Kameka.
She's Kameka from the Aztecs, and they're discussing what they should do, and Luvik leans in to say something very important and says, I don't know what's going on.
He says it about 3 times, actually.
And it sums up that character, and you've talked about all these actors, and I just think the casting, all these people are cast in these roles, and I just think they do such a tremendous job. I love Ceron. I love his scientific thing, and John Woodnut does such a great job. Like, you know, we're betrayed, Tremes, and Margot Vandenberg as Keturah, I really hate her. Like, as a character, because it's sort of like, well, we're going to just kill the doctor, kill the strangers, and then, of course, when we get the new keeper, it's sort of like, oh, well,
we'd better do what he says.
Exactly. It's sort of like she's after her own skin. It's very much like Downton Abbey, where you've got the Maggie Smith character, who's very much in the past, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
and things need to stay the same, and, you know, this is the way we've always done it. And so that parallel now sort of reminds me of her. But they're all, I just think, giving such Shakespearean and wonderful performances, and I think it's one of the strengths of this story. You know, John Black then cast Sheila Ruskin as Cassia, who I just feel for her, like, and at other times I just want to punch her in the face, you know?
Yeah. It's a really actorly performance.
Her performance.
Yeah, yeah. Oh. And you hit on something with the Shakespeare thing, and I think that this is said quite often about this show, that at the time it's made, the BBC is producing a thing called A Season of Shakespeare, where they do every Shakespeare play, and they're about 2 hours long, depending on the sort of source material. They're all shot in the studio, and the sets all look very similar to the set from Keeper of Traken, like, you know, with the sky. Like, I love the sky in The Grove. I think it looks spectacular, and that's how they do the outdoor scenes in A Season of Shakespeare.
Okay, yeah.
And the costumes are very much like that. So the whole thing looks, production-wise, very much like that. But the scripts as well have sort of Shakespearean elements in it. And so Sheila Ruskin fainting.
That is one of the most hilarious things, when you're sort of like, there's a web of nothing here and I'm going to just collapse on the ground. Or when she's saying, no, he must not become the keeper or whatever.
Her, she does a little aside.
And he's going, what? What? nothing at all. Like, I really like that.
Yeah. And there's, like, you know, pulling people out from behind, things like Polonius in Hamlet. And some of the dialogue is in iambic pentameters, and you know, there's Shakespearean language. I think Ceron accuses them of meeting hugger mugger to like Polonius's burial, I think. There is a very sort of deliberate Shakespearean thing. And of course, thematically, there are scenes in Shakespeare like at the death of Duncan in Macbeth, or the death of Julius Caesar in Julius Caesar.
The madness of King Lear when he's out with the fool.
Yeah, so it's reflected like the king, the state of the monarch, like the death of a king results in nature going crazy, and there's storms and all of those kinds of
horses
things.
Horses eat each other.
The horses eat each other, it said. And so that's what's happening here. It's a huge theme in Shakespeare, and this is about a court discussing the succession of one monarch to another, and the whole health of the body politic depends on the health of the monarch, and even nature itself depends on the health of the monarch.
Mm. Something I quite like about that is, you know, of course, Trimas is named as keeper nominate. That doesn't happen. Cassia steps in and is usurped by the master, so the master becomes the keeper. But then finally, Luvik becomes a keeper. Luvik, who has been sitting there going, I don't know what to do, what do we do, I don't do anything. He is the one who makes the final decision. I will sacrifice myself for my people.
And I love how he does that, because it's a real rush, and he and Keturah are kind of with each other, and he goes, I'll go. And then sort of rushes off and sits in the chair, and it's just terrific. He's really great.
Bringing tears to my eyes. Like, it honestly is one of the most affected scenes for me in the history of the show. And what happens in the following story just left me utterly devastated. Utterly and totally devastated.
Yeah.
Right? I don't want to talk about it now, right? But it just really, really upsets me even to even think about it now. I just think with everything that has gone on in this story. We were talking a bit about, like, you know, the elements and the forces and that sort of getting upset. The scene with all the wind and all that sort of stuff, I don't think is that well done now.
No, but it's a stage thing.
Yes, yes.
It fits with the style of the production.
Yeah. There's a few little things, like in the direction. I'm sure there's one moment where the camera is coming into one of those step ups out of the grove, and I'm sure it hits it at some point. Like, there's a little bump, and I just went. So there's a few little things, and I don't actually like the meld at the end between Trimas and the master. I think that's really quite. I kind of go, it's really a bit crummy.
One special effect that I think works terrifically well is at the end of episode 3, where Cassia is covered with this superimposed effect because she's going to disappear and be replaced by the master.
Mm.
And she does her sort of actressy waving her arms around, but there's a point where it's just her hands coming out of this special effect.
Yeah, yeah.
And it looks really creepy. It's terrifying.
And I just want to talk about that. I think that is one of the most utterly horrific moments in the history of Doctor Who. And I went to bed and had nightmares. I was crying over that. And it affects me to this day. Even when I watch it, the fact that this woman is materialized on. She is just, that is her death. It is just so, she's done everything to protect her husband. You know, even having funny eyes like Thea from Image of the Fendal, which I really love it when they do those.
So they paint the eyes.
But it is funny how, like, you know, she'll just stun Trimas, but everybody else who gets zapped by it dies.
Well,
like,
she loves Trimas, you know.
Yeah. And that's very Shakespearean as well. The love between couples in Shakespeare almost always leads to people dying.
But, yeah, it just really affects me. Her entire death just really, really affects me. Besides Cassia, the other member of the family is, of course, Nyssa. And I think Sarah Sutton is great. You know, she's so natural. And I love the fact that Nyssa gets the iron bonder and gets to zap people. You know, she's actually given something. She's quite willing to take up arms, you know, at the first opportunity. That is the prerequisite of a companion who's willing to get in there and, you know, defend the Doctor and fight for good. You know, she'll do it again in the other Johnny Byrne script.
Yeah.
And, you know, she's not given many of these opportunities, which is, you know, so unfair. And we talked earlier about her relationship with Adric, and I like that they're this little duo that are trying to work on their own thing, which is parallel to the Doctor and Trimas discussing, you know, destroying the source in parallel. And I like the fact that she gets to go inside the TARDIS and see all that as sort of an introduction. Obviously, at this point, they hadn't decided that she was going to come aboard the crew in the next story. And I think the moment that Trimas becomes the master, I think, influences that script, because in Legopolis, there's that whole bit about, you know, she thinks it is her father. Now, if they didn't have Nyssa in there to do that, you know, who would it be? What would be going on in the plot? You know, that's a good 10 minutes of that plot that he needs her for.
She, I mean, she's a very experienced actor by this stage, isn't she? And she's done lots of things as a child.
Mm-hmm.
And she's pretty good here. She doesn't really appear until... She doesn't get a line until episode two, does she?
Does take a while for her to get that. Mm. But just, you know, her relationship with Cassia, you know, getting discovered in the grove and then telling the Proctor to send away the people. And
she's hilarious. Like, fabulously aristocratic, isn't she?
Yeah.
Again, that's another sort of Shakespearean thing, this sort of class thing. So they're the mob, you know, and... they're an offence against the dignity of the consuls or something. She's a fabulous princess in that scene.
I love the fact that they're when they do get put away downstairs, you know, she's going to break them out of the prison and all that sort of stuff. It reminds me always of that scene when they're actually in the cell with Tom, where he's got that bit of sawdust dangling from his nose.
I thought it was a spider web.
Oh, okay.
It looks like a great big bogey, doesn't
it? Yeah, a lot of people think it's a bogey.
Well, if you look at the ground, it's all got sawdust on it. It's obviously... Yeah. But it's there and then it's not, and then, it jumps between the different takes. It's always interesting to see. One of the things I really love is the flames that indicate that the keeper is dying. That whole concept of them being really, like, brightly lit and then gradually going down. I don't know why... I like these things, but I just do. It's just something, the visual of it just really, really appeals to me.
That is a thing called a flame bar, that thing with the flames. And if you imagine sort of a strip of metal that it's got gas jets inside and it shoots the flames up, it's the same thing, probably not the exact same one, but it's the same type of thing that I hold in front of the camera in the last episode when the Doctor's making his escape to have flames in front of him. Yeah. And they were very commonly used in television for fire scenes. So it's kind of like you can just have smoke going on in the background and have that flame bar close to the camera and the actor is never in any danger.
Right.
Now, here they do have fire in the background as well, but yeah, it's a flame bar.
Right. Mm. Well, there you go.
Interesting. Proctor Neiman. Interesting little character who's very much in it for himself, who eventually gets one of the rings of the consoles. I always love that thing that you get this special ring and you get to put it into the console and punch these magic numbers.
It's literally a secret decoder ring for our American listeners.
Like, I mean, that's really stupid, those numbers that the Doctor punches, the last three digits are 337. Like, I'm going, where are you making this up from? Like,
but that's the encryption key. There's dialogue, isn't there? They need to, it's all based on a single prime number.
Yeah, hold on. I've got it here. What's that piece of the mechanism? Oh, of course, a recursive integrator. How are the rings encoded? Gamma mode encryption. Then there'll be a single large prime number at the root of it, and we don't have the integer key.
Yeah, so there you go. So
see, that makes no sense to me. I don't understand.
That makes sense. Does that make sense? Yeah.
Okay.
Prime numbers are used in encryption, I think, and so they're entering the prime number in there too because they don't have all of the secret decoder rings.
Mm. I love his neckband and Cassia's neckband that they get to wear.
Which no one notices.
At all.
No one notices the neckband.
You've added that thing that occasionally glows red when you kill people. Where did you get that?
Speaking of which, that...
Where did she get it, actually? Did the Master nip outside and put it at the feet of the thing? If so, where's the door in Melka?
Well, you know, he's had to be doing something for the last 20 years.
I suppose.
Actually just started off as a normal bondage collar.
So can we talk about Jeffrey Beavers?
We could.
He's got a spectacular voice. Mm. It's really great. And it's sometimes really evil and sometimes a bit playful. There's some humour in it. It's just tremendous. All of his lines are wonderfully well delivered. And he's gone on to have a great career in the audiobooks, because no one else who played the Master in the original show is with us any longer. He's the one who reads the audiobooks that have the Master in them, and he's wonderful.
You know, why couldn't you cast somebody like him as the Master? Mm. Like, you don't have to look like Roger Delgado.
Yes.
Like, but of course, you know, at that time, that's not the thinking. His work in Big Finish as the Master is just spectacular. I think it's a real shame that he's not credited as the Master on screen. He's just credited as Melka, you know?
Yeah,
and I think once that reveal had happened, I think he should have been credited as the master.
In the final episode. Yeah.
But that all that stuff with Neiman and Tremas and the Melka asking Tremas as a reasonable man to execute Neiman and now yourself, that really does establish how unhinged the master is.
Yeah, he doesn't actually get to do anything sort of... Oh, he kills Cassia, I guess. But if you're going to reintroduce him, he's got to be kind of super evil, I think. Mm. And so having Neiman killed like that and having, you know, the Doctor forced to watch and stuff, that is nasty. It's nastier than the show has been for a while. But, you know, I think it's worth doing.
But very tellingly, it manages to be very nasty and horrific without resorting to blood and guts.
Yeah.
Because, of course, you know, early 80s, this is around the time, of course, Texas Chainsaw Massacre was 6 or 7 years before this. The Friday the 13th film series was really taking off. We were a couple of years off getting Nightmare on Elm Street. You know, slasher films were huge in this period. But Doctor Who is going, at this point, you know what, no. We're going to do what we did well at the beginning of this era. We're going to have psychological horror.
Yeah.
And it's really, really effective. And I think it's all the more effective for the reasons you were saying, Todd, of we have such excellent casting that when these characters do die, despite the fact we've only known them for half an hour or an hour, it means something.
Mm.
And we feel something for them. And I think we can imagine ourselves in that situation. And that is a criticism that will come back during the next few seasons of Doctor Who. Can we actually empathise with these characters?
I love how suave Melka is once he becomes the keeper and flicks in, you know, flits into Tremas's house or quarters, I should say, and, you know, is asking for certain things. It's back to his voice performance. Yeah, it's just wonderful. So wonderful.
Yeah. No, he sounds just super reasonable and sort of mild. He's terrific. He really is spectacular. You know, I think I'm liking this story a lot more hearing you talk about it, Todd. I was going to spend some time bitching about what I think, like the kind of flaws of the Bidmead era. And this exhibits some of them. There's a lot of kind of that thing that Brendan quoted earlier about gamma mode encryption and stuff isn't necessarily the most entertaining thing. There's something to be said about stick-on BBC beards.
They're a bit more obvious 30 years later.
But it does create a really vivid and coherent world, this story, and characters that you care about that aren't all men for a change. I think it is pretty good, and it looks great.
It's a world that I would have loved to have visited. Like, you know, there's some in Doctor Who, and that's one as a child that I would have loved to if it really happened, you know? Mm.
This story has a surprisingly long afterlife in the world's Big Finish because, of course, Jeffrey Beavers, as you mentioned, Nathan, not only is he reading the audiobooks for the BBC, they brought him back as the master opposite predominantly Tom Baker, but also Sylvester McCoy. He's done some excellent stories with Sylvester McCoy. There was Dust Breeding, where he originally comes back along with his wife, the late Carolyn John, of course. He's Mr. Elizabeth Shaw.
That is a tremendous audio.
Yeah.
Anybody out there, if you've not heard it, that is one to get.
What's it called?
Dust Breeding.
And also Master by Joe Lidster, which was one of the 40th anniversary stories, and it kind of goes into the Doctor and the Master's relationship. But in the last few years, he's mainly been acting alongside Tom in stories set before The Keeper of Traken.
Right.
He's had stories with Louise Jameson. I think he's got one coming up with Lala Ward. And there's even a trilogy this year called The Two Masters, where you've got Jeffrey Beavers, and he's doing a story with Peter Davison. You've got Alexander McQueen, who Big Finish have introduced as another new incarnation of the Master.
He's that guy from The Thick of It.
The Thick of It, yeah. And he's doing a story with Colin Baker. And then you've got The Two Masters, which is both of them with Sylvester McCoy.
Oh, I thought you were going to say they're going to have that dude from the TV movie.
Gordon Tipple is interviewed in Doctor Who magazine in the March issue of Doctor Who magazine. And it's quite a good interview. And they have a shot of him in full makeup and in full costume on the set which I don't think has ever been seen before.
I have to download that. I haven't been to the app for ages.
It's also got an interview with Eric Roberts, who is actually, quite a humble and down-to-earth guy and really enjoyed his time. And Jeffrey Beavers, whenever he talks about Doctor Who, we saw him at a convention 2 years ago, I think, when he came out here. And it was shortly after Carol and John had died. But he was talking about how he loved doing it even then, but now he's got this afterlife in the show as well.
He always talks about the fact that he wanted to use his own eyes as opposed to the previous
Peter Pratt goggly eyes.
With the goggly eye thing.
Yeah, well, I think that that's the right choice. That mask with the sausage fingers and stuff, it's too static.
Yeah. I think the big problem is like painting the teeth on his lips. And to his credit, he tries as much as possible not to move his lips while he's performing because he knows he's got the teeth on there.
I don't think they're meant to. I thought that
just cracked lips.
Cracked lips. I always read it that way. I know because you've got the Peter Pratt thing that had the skull teeth.
Yeah.
Which somehow still left him able to pronounce labial consonants, but whatever, like Skeletor.
Is that a real description? Labial content?
Yeah, did not
know that. Yeah. Okay.
So he can still pronounce those. But, you know, I always just assumed that those were his lips. And certainly because he does that hilarious big scream thing at the end. Because he and the Doctor meet very, very briefly and then things pretty much instantly go horribly wrong for him.
Mm.
And then he does that huge, massive, giant scream, which is he's such a sport for for doing that. And, you know, there clearly is lips in that scene.
You know what? I do think as well, bringing back the Master is inspired by Darth Vader. Because, you know, we've got Star Wars / A New Hope, which came out in 1977, followed by Empire Strikes Back in 1980.
Yeah.
So here, we get the Master is throughout the story, like Darth Vader is throughout the first film. But Darth Vader and Luke Skywalker have no interaction in the first film.
Yeah.
They have one fight together, which Han saves Luke from. Here, the Master and the Doctor have one scene together in the same room with the Doctor fully aware of who he is. You know, he's suspected for a little while. And as you say, Todd, he's a bit slow on the uptake. Even Adric notices that the readings are the same as the TARDIS before the Doctor does.
Which is what I was saying earlier about the fact that Adric, the character, that's a clever thing, whereas next year we're going to get him written like a 12-year-old.
Yeah,
Whereas here it's like he's a young man who's maturing and so he's worked this out. He's doing these independent things.
Yeah, so I think that that's possibly an influence because when we look at Graham Williams, of course, tried to emulate Star Wars by having big spaceship shots and really good models, whereas I think Doctor Who's kind of realised now, you know, let's emulate the classic kind of hero confronts villain. And if we're going to have a trilogy, the hero can win the battle in the first episode, but not the war.
Yeah.
And I think that's what happens here, you know, the Doctor frightens the Master off, but we do get that horrible ending where he takes over Tremas, who is a character, you know, we've really come to know and admire over these four episodes. And even that scene where he comes into conflict with the Doctor and the Doctor gives him that wonderful dressing down of
great.
When the source has been taken over and Trachan's in ruins and everyone's dead, at least you kept your honor intact. Yeah, and that with lesser actors, that line would have been screamed or shouted. Like, okay, as much as I love, say, John Pertwee and Colin Baker in the role, you know, that would have been a browbeating, thumping the desk.
Oh, no, but he over-enunciates the word intact so wonderfully. It's really good.
That's the thing. He's so still. He doesn't raise his voice. Mm-hmm. It's just his tone that changes. And again, Anthony Ainley doesn't rail against it. He just kind of quietly accepts that he does have to break his vow. And until this moment, everyone else has been breaking vows all around him, and he's trying to keep his honour, but he kind of comes to the realisation of, I have to give up this part of myself. And maybe that's foreshadowing, I don't know.
His terrible line is when he says, we're so fortunate to have met you, Doctor, at the end, which is just a hugely embarrassing line delivery. But it is foreshadowing what is just a scene like nothing that we've ever seen in Doctor Who before. So we have the standard, you know, thanks and goodbye.
And there's a really nice moment in the TARDIS between the Doctor and Adric, and there's
yeah.
which I just think is solidifying their relationship,
yep.
which I again I think adds to my liking of Adric throughout yep. these 8 episodes. But then...
Well, we think the show's over.
Mm.
And we get a scene back in Truk and we're talking about cleaning up and all of that sort of thing. And at the very beginning of that scene, the grandfather clock is visible in the background but not remarked upon. You actually see it, like, at the very start of that shot.
Yep.
And then Tremus, you know, goes up and touches it and we get a new body at last and stuff. And then the TARDIS dematerialises... And Nyssa walks into that shot. There's no cut. So the shot from which her father has been abducted just seconds before and turns around and, Father, where are you? So it ends on a question. You know, it's obviously a kind of cliffhanger to lead us into next week and the reintroduction of the Master. But do you remember it at the time? I just sort of was so astounded by it. And I did think at the time bringing the Master back properly, having an actor play him rather than him turning up every 5 years looking, you know, a bit gruesome. I thought it was a great idea. And certainly it's like, oh my God, what's going to happen now?
I'm with you. Again, I didn't know anything about the Deadly Assassin, right? So when the Master turns up, it's like a big shock, you know? Mm-hmm. And they don't make a big deal about it. Like, it's not a big continuity thing. That's just how he looks. He's at the end of his life cycle.
Yeah,
you know?
There's a line explaining.
And so because it's been so long since Roger Delgado, in my head, it's like this mythical character from the past, you know, is coming back. And so when he does that transformation, as a kid I thought it was great. Now I think it looks crummy. But the same look and everything, you know, it was sort of like, oh, my goodness, this is just like...
He doesn't look at the camera or anything. Like, you can barely see his new face. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's that stupid transformation. And then he says the line, you know, a new body at last, again, but with, like, he's back to the camera sort of thing. I think it's sort of ham-fistedly done. You do really want to see him properly.
No, see, I think it's deliberate. And I think it's so clever because the Master has spent the whole story using people and then using them to kill one another to try and get this power. His plan is foiled. Does he care? No, he's got a new body. He doesn't even care about you, the audience. He's just going to bugger off and cause mayhem elsewhere. I do think it's deliberate because John Black, as you say, Todd, he's not the best director, but he is very stylish and he is very stylized. I think if he'd wanted that to be a big moment of him turning to the camera and saying, look at my new face, we would have had that moment. No, it's the Master breaking the fourth wall in a very subtle way and having complete disregard for the audience. Yeah, you want to see my face? Come back next week.
And in fact, we don't see it next week,
no,
do we?
Exactly.
We just see him laughing. And when we do finally see him on Legopolis, that is actually quite a good reveal, and
yeah,
maybe
yeah.
it was worth waiting for.
It's the Holmesian thing. They're showing a bit of the monster at a time.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're just getting flashes. No, I think it's a conscious goad of the audience.
Well, I'm glad that we've turned Nathan around a bit on this story from what you're wanting to...
Yeah, I mean, I think there are flaws. I think there are problems with the performance and problems with the direction. And I do think there's too many BBC beards and a little bit too much talk about the science-y stuff. And
the moon's terrible.
I like the moon. And I like the sky. But there's a lot going for this.
There's just something about this that it is my favourite of the season.
We take off from Traken and not a moment too soon, but we will be back next week. For a chain of events that fragment how the universe is held together, there is only one thing we can do to prevent this, gentlemen. I'm afraid that all four of us will need to be in full rapport with the podcast. Richard will be back next week as we talk about Legopolis. Until then, please check us out online at flightthroughentirety.com, flightthroughentirety on Facebook and iTunes, FTE podcast on Twitter. Don't forget bondfinger.com, bondfingercast on Twitter, and bondfinger on Facebook and iTunes. Until then, may none of your honey have flies trapped in it. Thank you very much for listening and good night.
Good night.
See you soon.
Flector Entirety with Todd Bielby, Nathan Bottomley and Brendan Jones. Theme arrangement by Cameron Lamb. This episode, Web of Nothing, was recorded on the 20th of March 2016. The next episode will be released on May 22nd. If all the stars were silver and the sky a giant purse in my hand, I'd still discover that the Daypole Melker action figure was really expensive.
The Keeper of Traken.
Sorry.
It's 20th of March.
It's Traken.
Traken.
Just once.
Do you remember that in Gary Downey's Doctor Who cookbook, Johnny Byrne's recipe is the Kipper of Traken?
Oh, God.
There's even an illustration of a kipper in Traken gowns in front of the sauce cabinet.
That's really, really sad.
I'd love to have the Doctor Who cookbook.
What culinary delights await you?
Well, there's a profile on Jackie Lane which explains she's actually Jocelyn Lane from New York, which is complete bollocks. He just couldn't find any autobiographical info. Like, she sent her a recipe to him, but he couldn't find any autobiographical information about her. So he's like, right, I'll make something up.
Well, you could do that in 1980, whatever.
And then, you know, Lala Ward's recipe is some. Is rabbit with streaky bacon and shallots.
Freshly shot.
On the estate.
Fraser's recipe is some kind of soup with Dalek croutons.
Brilliant.
Garlic croutons.
All right.
Oh, that's right. Liz Sladen does cauliflower cheese, so it's the illustration is Sarah Jane sneaking up on a crinoid with a knife and fork.
It's pretty awful.
It must be on eBay. I'm going to buy it.
We'll just wait for the clock again.
I thought I'd stopped that clock.
Once again, we wait for Ruthba. You don't get this kind of excitement on 42 to Doomsday, dear listener.
No, that's right. Trust your doctor.
20.
I know, they're so young, aren't they? It's crazy.
20!
Yeah. Kian turned 20 yesterday. Or today, his time. I think.
You informed me of this fact. I chose to obliterate it from my memory.
Kian doesn't know the struggle of his family wanting to watch Adam's Family Values rather than the telly movie.
Yeah, I've got shirts that old.